Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Okay. So, today, I thought I would start off by reading a little pamphlet that I got published by the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, title of which is Energy and the Need for Nuclear Power. And the author's name is given on the cover as PMS Jones. Now, PMS Jones is a real person. As is indicated in the back, his name is Peter. Professor Peter Jones, Chief Economic Advisor to the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, which is a very common byline in articles in the UK AEA magazine, Atom, which I've read to you from that magazine before, and I have several years' worth of it, which I'm gradually scanning and making available online. For example, there was a paper that I read, or address that I read, by Sir John Hill, the role of nuclear energy in the overall energy mix. And I've gone back and I've added a link to scans of that issue so that you can read it if you want. You got to look in the weekly posts section under AnonRadio.net. There's my a step farther out weekly posts. Anyway, but so, Energy and the Need for Nuclear Power by Professor Peter Jones, Chief Economist of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. Now, again, I'm going to post a link so you can look at this booklet because it is lavishly illustrated and a lot of the impact is lost without the figures. Let's see, greetings to Claudio M. and Maxim, Dirty Rig, Unimagine. All the people in com. Now, where we are. Nuclear power is not new. Electricity from Britain's first nuclear power station at Calder Hall was fed into the national grid over 30 years ago, and since then, nuclear power stations have come to produce about a fifth of all electricity generated in the UK. Worldwide, at the end of 1986, there were nearly 400 nuclear reactors producing electricity in 26 countries. Another 140 were under construction, and a further 110 planned. By 1990, almost a quarter of the electricity produced in the non-communist industrialized countries will come from nuclear energy. The two main incentives behind this growing nuclear contribution have been lower costs and fears about the long-term availability of fossil fuels. After an initial period of development, during which electricity from nuclear reactors was likely to be dearer than that from coal or oil-fired power stations, nuclear was expected to become significantly cheaper than either. In large part of the industrial world, this expectation has been realized. Figure 1, showing that in North America, the savings can be up to 30% compared with coal, but there's also areas where coal is 25% cheaper. This is lifetime cost. In Europe, it's a savings of 15 to 40% over a lifetime. Nowhere is coal cheaper than nuclear. Fears about shortages of coal, oil, and natural gas are less pressing now than they seemed 30 years ago. This is due to the drastic reduction in world economic growth that followed the trade boom of the late 1960s and the first oil crisis of 1973. Other factors have been the discovery of sizable additional quantities of oil, gas, and coal, and the reduction in energy demand, particularly for oil, that followed sharp rises in fuel prices during the 1970s. Nevertheless, many countries do not have reserves of these fossil fuels within their own territory, and for them, fears of shortages arising from political actions beyond their control remain very real. The UK is not one of these countries. It is well endowed with sources of energy, with its own oil and gas, as well as reserves of coal that will last several hundred years at present rates of consumption. Indeed, The UK is fortunate at present in being among the few major industrialized countries able to produce more energy than it consumes. Against this background, it is not surprising that many people ask whether the UK needs nuclear power. Even on a worldwide scale, there is not an obvious shortage of other sources of energy. Oil is in plentiful supply again, and the days of high oil prices seem, at least for the moment, a thing of the past. There are large reserves of coal in many parts of the world. There is more natural gas than was thought a few years ago. And there are the renewable energy sources, the wind, waves, tides, and sunlight, the energy from which remains largely untapped. Why, then, do we need nuclear power? To understand why many of us believe that nuclear energy will be an essential part of the world's and the UK's future supplies, we need to look at how energy affects our lives and how changing lifestyles will affect the demand for energy. We need to explore what this means for future energy requirements and the resources that may be available to meet them. Finally, we have to ask whether the UK's particularly favored position places us in a different situation to that of the majority of the other industrial nations. And then the section headed Energy, what is it? We know what energy can do, and we use it all day and every day of our lives, but it is not something we can catch hold of. It is what is used every time any change occurs in the world around us. It is needed to lift or move, to cut, drill, mold, bend, or otherwise shape materials, to heat or cool, to melt, bake, boil, or dry, to produce chemicals, fertilizers, or plastics, to mine and quarry, to travel and transport, to plow and pump, to spin, weave, and sew, to provide light, and to operate electronic equipment. Hold on a moment. I'm going to post something. I'm going to... Here we go. Energy can be released by burning coal, oil, gas, and wood. It can be extracted from wind, waves, tides, and rivers. It can be changed from one form to another. Thus, the heat from burning oil can be converted to steam pressure in a boiler. The pressure can drive a turbine to produce electricity. The electricity can be converted back to heat in a cooker, electric fire, or furnace, or into light for our homes, or mechanical motion to drive tools or industrial machinery. Sunlight can be used to produce heat or electricity, and wind or wave power can be used to drive machinery. Figure 2 illustrates this. While energy can be released, extracted, used, or converted, it cannot be created or destroyed. When we use it, some may be changed to other forms of useful energy. The remainder is spread out and lost as waste energy, which is of no further practical value. Most ends up as low-grade heat, a car energy. A car engine gets energy by burning petrol and converts this to motion, but all the energy is finally lost in the form of small temperature rises to the air around the car and to the road surface. Whether we are subsistence farmers struggling for our living in a poor country, or wealthy citizens of an advanced industrial society, our homes and all the goods we own, our food, drink, and clothing, our work and our travel all require the use of energy, though the source of that energy and the amounts used will be very different in the two societies. And there's Figure 3, World Population and Energy Consumption, which is an interesting little diagram. Patterns of Energy Use, the Developing World. There's, like I say, a lot of good figures here, which is why I'm going to put the link so you can look at the scans yourself. 3/4 of the world's population live in developing countries. They consume barely 1/4 of the world's energy, see Figure 3. For large numbers of people, living standards are extremely low. They have barely enough food for survival, few possessions, and are very vulnerable to the natural disasters of drought and disease. Production of food often still depends on human muscle power, or for the lucky few, on animal power. 2 billion people, nearly 1/4 of the world's population, have no access to electricity. For many, firewood is the most vital source of energy, but it is being consumed at an alarming rate, leading to increasing destruction of woodland and loss of farmland through soil erosion in several parts of the world. More effort then goes to the search for fuel, living standards worsen, and the deserts expand their grip on the planet. On average, each person in the developing countries consumes only 1/6 of the energy of a person in Western Europe or Japan, and only 1/15 of a person in the USA. See Figure 4. The loss of forests is not new. It contributed to changes in lifestyle and in relative strength of nations in the Middle East thousands of years ago. In Britain in the 14th century, the destruction of woods and forests to feed industrial furnaces and meet domestic needs, as well as to provide a major material for construction, left the cottager with, quote, a cold hearth and a bread and cheese diet, and sorely restricted the output of manufactures. Figure 5, which is nowhere referred to in the text, is an illustration of peasants, possibly English, I'm not sure. The caption is, living in mud huts with only one room for sleeping, cooking, and living. Different ages and sexes herding together, their cottages have no windows, but a hole through a mud wall to admit air and light, into which a bundle of rags or turf is thrust at night to stop it up. And the credit there is to Cobden. Access to energy and the living standards of the peasant population of Britain were not so different 300 years ago to that prevailing in much of the undeveloped world today. The average man was a servant working long hours for small reward, with few possessions other than his clothes and a few pieces of furniture. Although some use was made of wind and water power, and metal and pottery industries were in existence using charcoal or coal fuels, the production and inland distribution of food and goods were dependent almost entirely on either human or animal muscle power, and this had held back economic growth for centuries. With the invention of the steam engine in the 18th century, great increases in production were made possible, and with them, in living standards. See Figure 6. The modern Briton works fewer hours, travels afar, has his own transport and entertainment systems, and a wide range of machines to do his work. He can afford to buy food and goods brought from all parts of the world. Yes, Figure 6 is a table entitled Human Energy Consumption Throughout History, which is set up per head of population in 1,000 kilocalories, which, of course, is your typical diet is given as, 2,000 kilocalories. Data taken from an article by Earl Cook entitled The Flow of Energy in an Industrial Society, which was in Scientific American in September 1971. It is an escapable fact. I think he means inescapable. Bad copy editing there. It is an inescapable fact that we can only enjoy the material benefits arising from the goods we are able to produce for ourselves, or that we have inherited from previous generations, or those arising from the goods we can obtain by trading our own products and services. The amount we can produce is limited by the energy we have at our disposal and the level of our technology. The energy we can have is itself limited by the share of our effort that we can afford to devote to producing it, or the amount that we can get in exchange for our surplus produce. The very poor countries are caught in a trap with no surplus. And survival alone is their major challenge. Only when we are able to produce more than we need to consume can we begin to invest in plant, machinery, roads, and transport. Once the barrier of subsistence is overcome, living standards can rise at an accelerating rate, a rate that is far higher now with the accumulated technology and knowledge we have gained than it was 200 years ago, This, however, requires that energy is available in quantity at a cost that can be afforded. The high rates of economic growth that can be achieved can be seen in the recent past in Southeast Asia, where they have taken full advantage of modern technology. See Figure 7. The less developed an economy, the more its growth depends on access to energy-using activities. Energy to make and use fertilizers and agricultural machinery to raise crop yields, transport and construction to move, store, and process produce, machinery and buildings for new wealth-creating industries. Their often rapidly growing populations will add to their energy requirements, even to maintain existing living standards, and the population of the developing countries as a group could well grow by some 60% by 2020. As a result, the energy demands of the developing countries as a group are expected to grow sharply, perhaps trebling by 2020, and accounting for nearly 40% of the world's total consumption by that date. The developed world. The developed world is very different. It already makes wide use of energy in all aspects of its activities. The average Briton, Frenchman, German, or Japanese, and his family use energy at a rate that his or her 17th century forebears would find incredible. Although in the richest industrial countries, a large majority of households already have a car, a cooker, a television, a washing machine, a refrigerator, and a number of the other domestic appliances considered essential to modern living, there are many that still do not. Figure 8. This is very curious because it appears to show that in the UK, in 1985, fewer than 10% of total households had dishwashers. The number of households that had computers was about 15%, twice the number that had dishwashers. How do you like that? The computer was actually already more common than the dishwasher in 1985. That's really something. Clearly, there is a limit to the number of appliances and tools a household can use, and a limit to the heating or cooling and air conditioning and transport it requires. Nevertheless, there are benefits for many from having the extra freedom of more than one car in the family, and even a second holiday home when it can be afforded. There is little sign that overall demand has reached the final level, where everyone's wants are fully satisfied, and this means more goods will be demanded. However, the energy needs of the industrialized countries, such as our own, the USA and Japan, may well not grow as fast in the future as in the past. Energy will be used more efficiently. Buildings will be better insulated, cars more fuel efficient, production processes more modern. Growth in their economies will ultimately depend less on industries that are heavy consumers of energy, such as iron and steel, and chemicals production, and more on newer industries such as electronics and computer manufacture and on service activities. Even so, it is difficult to see how economic growth over the long term could be achieved without continuing growth in their energy demand. Failed to account here for the energy demand of computing itself, which is rapidly, rapidly growing to the point that it means that the computer industry predicts it soon to surpass all other energy uses, which would be very difficult because we need to build a lot of power plants. They don't seem to account for that. Even if the economic emphasis in the older industrial nations shifts away from energy-hungry industries, they will still need to use steel, glass, concrete, and chemicals, and they will have to get these from the nations prepared to produce them so that at least as much energy may be used, although in different countries. The picture, then, is of a continuing increase in the world demand for energy, even allowing for the greater energy efficiency and other factors that will help to limit growth of demand in the industrialized countries. How will these energy demands be met? How much energy will we need? Energy consumption worldwide has grown some 20-fold since 1850, whilst the world's population has grown only 4-fold. Since 1955, when the first nuclear power stations were built, consumption has trebled. The initial growth was mainly satisfied by expanding coal supplies, but the last 50 years has seen an enormous increase in the use of oil and natural gas. See Figure 9. During the 1950s and 1960s, these fuels, particularly oil, were plentiful and cheap, and their abundance and cheapness was one major factor in the unprecedented rates of growth achieved in the booming economies of the industrial nations. The oil supply crises of 1973 and 1979-80, and the accompanying major price rises, which were reflected in other fuels too, have contributed to a prolonged world recession. This has held down the growth in energy demand and concentrated attention on the more efficient use of energy. There are some very different views about how energy demand will change in the future. Some believe that the days of high economic growth will never return, that still more efficient use of energy will reduce requirements, and that the citizens of the developed industrial nations are close to having all the goods and energy-using appliances they need. If this were to prove true, the increases in energy demand in the industrial countries over the next 50 years could be quite small compared with the last 50. SDF user Dirty Rig in Com proposes someone write an article, The Cloud and the Need for Nuclear Internet, and I am completely in agreement with this idea. Others believe that high economic growth will return, provided there is a plentiful supply of cheap energy and essential raw materials. The efficiency of energy use might then increase even more quickly as new technologies take over. However, energy would be used for new purposes, and there need be no flattening off in the improvement in living standards. Without such a development, it is hard to see how full employment can return in the industrial countries. If this view were to prove true, then energy demand in the industrial nations might double or even treble again in the next 30 years. As we have seen, the developing countries will need to increase their energy use substantially to keep pace with population growth. If they are to improve their living standards significantly, a 4 or even 5-fold increase would be needed. This would still leave them, in 2020, with less than 1/2 the energy per head of population in the industrialized countries. Again, views differ on what is likely to be achieved. Some countries' economies may break out of the subsistence trap, others will not. Some are already well on the path of upward growth, others are deeply in debt, still others are experiencing famine. There is no way of knowing what the future will be. It will lie probably somewhere between the extremes, perhaps with world demand roughly doubling by 2020. Whatever the outcome, two things are clear. Energy demand in 2020 will be higher than it is now. Energy supply must be able to meet the demand at a reasonable cost if it is not to be a constraint on economic growth. There's Figure 10 is Growth in Population and Energy Demand, 1985-2020. Where will our energy come from? Nearly 60% of the world's energy today is met from oil and natural gas. I suppose he means energy demand. Oil. There is still a large amount of oil available to be recovered. Indeed, known reserves would supply present-day needs for some 35 years, and more will be discovered. Some estimates put the ultimate amount remaining to be found at twice the known reserves. However, oil is a depleting resource, and there is general agreement that it will not be possible to continue increasing its supply as in the past. New finds are largely in more hostile areas, like the North Sea, where they are more costly to recover than supplies from the Middle East. Of the resources remaining, a large part will be extra heavy crude oil, tar sands, and shales, which will also be costly to convert to usable products. Demand and production grew threefold between 1950 and 1979, but there has since been a 10% drop in consumption. This is because there has been a deliberate switch to other fuels in many applications, including to nuclear power for electricity generation. The switch is a reaction to high prices and uncertainty about future supplies. However, for many users, there is no ready alternative to oil, for example, in road and air transport. Oil is also hard to replace in some uses, where its ease of handling gives it a special advantage, or where it would be difficult and costly to use other fuels. There is likely to be a continuing growth in demand in these markets, although there is room for further savings in the use of oil for heating and electricity production, in the developed nations. Any upsurge in demand could lead rapidly to rising prices, which would renew pressures to conserve oil for essential uses. Prices could also become vulnerable again to supply disruptions. Although the Middle East now accounts for barely 20% of world production, over half the world's known oil reserves lie in that region. See Figure 11. The Middle East's political instability could therefore affect both the availability and price of supplies in the longer term as reserves in other parts of the world are used up. So yes, Figure 11 shows geographic distribution of oil, coal, and gas reserves. Natural gas. Proven reserves of natural gas are a little smaller in energy terms than those of oil, but at present rates of consumption, they will last until about the middle of the next century. Further discoveries will be made. However, about 40% of existing reserves lie in the USSR and 25% in the Middle East. Long-distance pipelines will bring supplies to Western Europe, but there must be a limit to the extent to which Western Europe will want to become dependent on supplies which might be subject to sudden disruption. Must there? The difficulty of transporting natural gas other than by pipeline will limit the rest of the world's access to these reserves. In the long term, conversion to liquid fuels or shipment at high pressures may ease access to supplies, but at higher costs. Oil and natural gas will continue to provide a major contribution to world energy supplies until well into the next century. However, there is little scope for greatly increasing their supply in the long term. Prices will rise as the reserves are used up and competition for the remainder intensifies. The need for more difficult and complex technology to recover and convert them to useful forms will also force up costs and prices. Coal. Proven world reserves of coal are large, over three times those of oil and natural gas together, see Figure 12. Consumption worldwide increased by about a third in the 10 years up to 1985 as countries turned away from oil, mainly by switching to coal for electricity generation and as a source of bulk heat in industry. In the more distant future, coal will be required increasingly for conversion to a liquid fuel and to substitute natural gas, and as a source of chemicals. However, while reserves of coal are large, not all of these will be cheap to exploit and bring to their markets. Coal is likely to become dearer in the long term as demand grows and more difficult and expensive resources have to be mined. This will make it an increasingly expensive option, particularly if it alone were to be relied on to meet growing world energy requirements. Figure 12 is very interesting. It shows coal, oil, gas, uranium used in thermal reactors, then uranium used in fast reactors, which is a much, much larger bar than any of the others. Nuclear power. World production of nuclear power is growing fast. It increased fourfold in the 10 years up to 1986 and now provides around a fifth of the electricity generated in the industrialized countries and meets about 5% of the world's primary energy consumption. In 1985, it produced energy equivalent to 340 million tons of coal, or some 500 million tons. I'm sorry, 340 million tons of oil, or some 500 million tons of coal. Figure 13 shows the contribution being made in various countries by percentage, not absolute value. Figure 13, the 20 countries with the highest nuclear shares of generation in 1986. Uranium provides the fuel used in nuclear reactors. Used in the type of nuclear reactors now in operation, the world's known resource base of uranium is about the same in energy content as that of proven oil reserves. Ultimate low-cost resources of uranium may be some 2 to 4 times larger. They are therefore large, but do not compare with coal so long as uranium use is largely limited to existing commercial nuclear reactors. These reactors, the so-called thermal reactors, are able to use only a small fraction of the energy available in uranium. However, in the next generation of reactor, the fast reactor, virtually all the energy in the uranium can be used, thus increasing the energy recoverable from the world's uranium resources, from the world's uranium reserves, some 60-fold. Now, there's a distinction in mining terms between reserves and resources. Moreover, since the cost of extracting uranium is an insignificant part of the cost of the electricity generated in the fast reactor, the uranium resource can be extended to include the large amount of uranium that would otherwise be uneconomic to exploit, possibly even to the vast amounts which occur in very low concentration in seawater. Under such circumstances, uranium could contribute in the long term very much more to energy than all the fossil fuels put together. To illustrate the enormous energy content of uranium, we can note that the UK alone already has stocks of depleted uranium, 25,000 tons, that, if used through a fast reactor, would provide the energy equivalent of all the UK's economically recoverable coal resources, about 45,000 million tons. Fast reactors have attractive safety features, and their technology is already proven. Indeed, the UK first generated electricity from a fast reactor in 1959. Large fast reactors are operating in France, the USSR, and the UK. What remains is to demonstrate the performance of the reactors and their fuel plant at full commercial scale. Current thinking is that fast reactors will become the cheapest source of baseload electric power. When this will happen depends on the rate of development of reactor design and the future price of uranium and nuclear fuel cycle services. The United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority believes that electricity from a series of commercial-size fast reactors served by commercial-size fuel plants could be comparable in cost to that from existing thermal reactors even at current nuclear fuel prices. These fast reactors might be coming into operation in the second decade of the next century, by which time increases in uranium prices might make them even more attractive. Renewables. The quantity of uranium was fixed when the Earth was formed, although its concentration in particular ores was due to later geological processes. Coal, oil, and natural gas resources were formed long ago from decaying biological materials, and their replacement, if it occurs at all, is extremely slow. Some natural gas, methane, is formed from non-biological sources, radioactive decay of minerals in the Earth's interior, but there is no evidence that such gas accumulates in usable quantities. In practice, therefore, supplies of both uranium and fossil fuels are limited to what exists in the Earth's crust and oceans for uranium. Renewable resources have no such limitation. They take advantage of the power of sunlight and the effects of gravity, which between them give rise to a number of energy sources which replenish themselves continuously. Hydroelectricity is generated from flowing rivers, using dams and reservoirs for all but the smallest schemes. It is an established renewable energy source that has been exploited for many years. It currently provides 7% of the world's energy, and there is some scope for increasing its contribution in many parts of the world. When available, it can often provide very cheap electricity. A great deal of research has been carried out in recent years into other ways of harnessing renewable energy, by using the winds, waves, and tides to generate electricity, or by using the sun's rays directly to provide heat or electricity, or through vegetation, biomass, to provide new fuels. This research has shown that some of these methods are attractive and can provide energy at costs which compete with those of other fuels. Indeed, some of the technologies are already being used. For example, electricity is being generated in small amounts using the wind and the tides, and in special situations using sunlight. In some countries, the Earth's own internal heat is being exploited. However, research has also shown that there are limitations to the size of the contribution that may be expected from the renewable energy sources, even though the resources themselves may be large. These limitations come about because, A, renewable energy is generally spread over wide areas, and the technology required to capture and concentrate it is expensive in relation to the energy obtained. B, the energy is not always available when needed. Rivers can dry up and biomass crops can fail in periods of drought. The wind does not always blow. In northern Europe, the greatest amount of solar radiation occurs in the summer, but the need for space heating is greater in winter. C. It can take a long time for new technologies to come into widespread use. One of the most attractive ways of using renewable energy in countries such as the UK is by designing buildings so that they will capture and retain the sun's heat. But this can only come about as existing buildings are demolished and replaced. Renewable resources will be important and economic in some applications. They can be expected to meet a growing proportion of the world's energy needs in the future, but it is difficult to see how this can be more than a small proportion over the next 40 to 50 years. Their biggest potential share is in the developing world, where local energy demand may not justify large energy schemes, and some renewable sources are abundant. However, cost will be all important and will limit what can be achieved. Now, the comment I would make here is that a lot of renewable energy development has completely ignored economics in recent years. The case for nuclear power. Energy supplies from both coal and nuclear power, oddly enough those words, coal and nuclear power, are in boldface, could be increased considerably, and both would be able to meet increased demand for centuries to come. With fast reactors, nuclear power could last for thousands of years. Oil and natural gas will contribute significantly for well over 30 years at current rates of use, but have no prospects for long-term expansion. A doubling of world energy demand, with oil and gas use held at present levels, would need a 3.5-fold increase from other sources. For example, a trebling of coal supplies and quadrupling of nuclear, or a doubling of coal and 12-fold increase in nuclear, or with a 10% share from renewable energy, a doubling of coal and quadrupling of nuclear. The price of all fossil fuels must increase as reserves are depleted and more difficult sources have to be brought into production. Nuclear electricity costs need not increase significantly above those now experienced because fuel costs are a smaller part of the total cost of its production, particularly in the fast reactor. Some renewable sources, additional to those in use, have promise, but their contribution is generally expected to be limited by availability, scale, and cost. Only nuclear, therefore, offers the long-term prospect of meeting the growth of world energy demand while keeping energy costs close to present levels. At present, nuclear power is used mainly to produce electricity, but nuclear heat is used on a limited scale for district heating and manufacturing, and this could be expanded in the future. Even so, nuclear could not become the dominant energy source for a very long time. How will the benefits of nuclear power be felt? There are four main ways in which benefits arise. Fossil fuel savings. Generating electricity already accounts for 25% of the world's consumption of fossil fuels. Using nuclear energy to produce electricity reduces the need to burn these fuels so that they will last longer. Whereas the uranium used to fuel nuclear reactors has no other uses. Oil, gas, and coal are current or potential feedstocks to the world's chemical industry. From them can come the plastics, synthetic drugs, dyes, and many other products on which we rely heavily. Oil provides the only convenient and compact fuel for much of our transport, and when it is depleted, liquid fuels made from gas or coal will be needed increasingly. Long-term alternatives might be hydrogen, which would be produced from water using nuclear electricity, or for road and rail vehicles, the direct use of electricity for propulsion. Lower prices. If less oil, gas, and coal are used, costs and prices will stay lower than they otherwise would be. This will benefit all of us, but it will be particularly important for the developing countries for whom the cost of importing fuel will be a continuing and increasing burden. While the richer countries will be able to afford higher fuel prices, the poorer developing countries will find it much harder to do so. By conserving the world's fossil fuels, nuclear power can indirectly benefit the developing countries. The larger the nuclear share, the slower the rate of rise of fossil fuel prices will be. Economic activity. Higher energy costs mean that more effort is being put into getting energy, and that less is therefore available to produce other goods and services. Nuclear power, by providing a lower cost energy source, releases resources which can be used by individuals or society as a whole to improve standards of living. The freed resources may be used to produce goods or for social purposes. Examples include improved health care, education, roads, etc., sponsorship of the arts or investment in scientific and technological development, aid to the less well-off within the country, aid to the developing world. Environmental issues. Burning fossil fuels produces carbon dioxide. There is concern among meteorologists that increasing consumption of fossil fuels is leading to a buildup of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. In time, this could raise temperatures, much as the glass in a greenhouse increases the temperature of the air inside, and there could be harmful effects on climate. More research is needed to understand whether this concern is justified, but at this stage it would seem unwise to assume that the world will be able to continue indefinitely its consumption of fossil fuels. Nuclear power offers a way of meeting increasing production and is the only feasible way of replacing all fossil fuels if this were ever to be found necessary. The other noxious emissions from coal burning, some of which contribute to the acid rain, which many believe is harming lakes and forests in the industrial world, can be reduced, but at a cost. Oil burning in power plants, furnaces, or road vehicles may also contribute to environmental damage. Use of nuclear power would eliminate the source of some of these problems, both directly in electricity production and where nuclear electricity is substituted for fossil fuel in heating, for example. Worries about nuclear power. People worry about the safety of nuclear power and the effect on the environment of having to deal with nuclear wastes. The nuclear industry is confident that both safety and wastes can be managed so that the risks to the public and the workforce are kept at levels at least as low as those from other industries. This view was endorsed by the inspector, Sir Frank Layfield, at the Sizewell Inquiry. It is outside the scope of this article to deal with the complex technical issues involved. The choice for the UK. During the early 1980s, the UK has been able to produce more energy of all types than it has needed for its own consumption. In the 1990s, this will no longer be true as oil resources are depleted. Nevertheless, our coal could see us through for a long time, provided we could afford to import oil for transport uses. We have even had an excess of electricity production capacity due to economic growth and electricity demand in the 1970s failing to reach the levels that had been planned for. By the mid-1990s and into the next century, new power stations will be needed, both to replace old and expensive to run ones that are reaching the ends of their lives and to meet the extra demand for electricity. New stations planned today should still be operating in 40 to 50 years' time, so that current fuel prices are of little relevance to the decision on what types of station to build. If we exclude the transport sector, nearly a fifth of the energy used in the UK is supplied in the form of electricity, and demand for it is growing faster than the demand for energy in general. See Figure 14. Figure 15 shows the many different ways in which electricity is now used. New developments often make electricity the cheapest way of meeting a need for energy, and energy-saving measures, like insulation of buildings, can increase the demand for electricity for this reason, allowing it to substitute for coal, oil, or gas. The UK's nuclear power stations currently produce around one-fifth of the country's electricity, and this proportion will rise to one-quarter when the stations at present being commissioned or under construction are fully operational. Operating these stations saves the generating boards, and hence the country, some £500 million a year in fuel and other operating costs, a saving that will increase to £1,000 million when the new stations are operational. £1,000 million is about the same as the amount of money spent each year on the hospital building program. The choice facing the UK is whether to build nuclear or coal-fired power stations. Some of the benefits of choosing nuclear are the same as those described earlier: fossil fuel savings, lower energy and fuel prices, higher standards of living, environmental insurance, and reduced pollution. Coal saving itself may not appear to be of major value to a nation with large resources like the UK. However, coal saved will be available for other uses and for export, provided it is priced competitively. Supplies will be freed at a time when world demand and prices are likely to be rising. Even at current coal prices, nuclear electricity will be cheaper, and lower electricity prices will leave the consumer better off. The effect of the competition should help to keep prices down, and this too will benefit the consumer. The greater spending power of electricity consumers will help to stimulate sales of other goods and services and provide employment. Lower energy costs for industry will help to keep it competitive internationally. Nuclear power will help the UK to limit or reduce release of carbon dioxide, acid gases, and other pollutants to the atmosphere. Use of nuclear power in the UK should additionally provide diversity, which will reduce risks of power supply shortages arising from interruption of any one fuel source. It will also reduce the consequences of any unforeseen price rises of fossil fuels. Provide growing direct employment in the nuclear industry and design and manufacturing experience, which may lead to the new export business in this area. Reduce the higher risks of accidents, disease, and pollution associated with coal mining and use. In the longer term, renewables like wind or geothermal hot rocks or tidal barrages may add to the contribution to electricity production already coming from hydropower in the UK. The total contribution looks likely to be limited to below one quarter of total supplies for technical availability and cost reasons. The choice between coal, renewable sources, and nuclear power will not be exclusive. We will continue to use all three to meet our electricity needs. Indeed, a mixture of plant types is necessary for the most economic operation of the electricity network. Even though nuclear power is the cheapest option for a new baseload plant, which operates almost continuously, it is not the cheapest source for peak supplies, which are demanded over relatively short periods of the day. What can we conclude? Energy demand will grow. Fossil fuel prices will rise, and oil and gas will be unable to maintain their share in supplies very far into the future. There will be a growing need for extra energy, which can only come from coal, nuclear, or renewable sources, and probably from a mixture of all three. A non-nuclear policy, apart from its damaging effects on the environment, would push energy prices up, render the economy vulnerable to disruption, make industry less competitive, reduce standards of living, and run the risk of pushing unemployment higher. Nuclear power is available, proven, and has the greatest potential in resource terms. It is also among the cheapest options. Its use will be environmentally and economically beneficial. It would be unrealistic, however, to expect nuclear to increase its share of the world total primary energy supply to much above a fifth by 2020, if that, although in the long term a much greater share could be achieved. An enormous expansion of coal supplies will also be needed in the meantime, perhaps a trebling, unless this can be cut down by conservation and contributions from renewable sources. The difficulties of achieving such a large growth in the coal industry, plus the related environmental risks, argue for the rapid adoption of nuclear power and nuclear heat plant wherever this is technically and economically sensible. In helping themselves, the industrial nations like the UK will also help the developing countries, which cannot benefit so readily from nuclear power, by freeing fossil fuels, which can substitute directly for wood fuel in their economies. About the author, Professor Peter Jones is Chief Economic Advisor to the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. He holds a professorial research fellowship at the University of Surrey, is Vice Chairman of the Nuclear Energy Agency's Fuel Cycle Committee, and Chairman of OECD NEA Expert Groups on the Economics of Nuclear Power and the Nuclear Fuel Cycle. Booklet published by the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, 11 Charles Second Street, London, SW1Y4QP. Designed by Bradley Dyer Design Group, Raygate. Printed by Belmont Press, Northampton, November 1987. I will remark that this booklet uses the same annoying sans serif typeface that was used in the UK AEA magazine Atom after its format change. It changed from a booklet format to a larger format about 1977, and they adopted this awful, very lightweight sans serif font that's difficult to read. One argument Professor Jones doesn't make in that booklet is one that I think was raised by Bennett Lewis of AECL, which impressed me quite a bit, which was the argument that there's a moral imperative not to burn in power stations fuels which can be used in domestic settings. That is to say, you know, gas can be burned in your domestic stove, your domestic heater very easily. Lignite coal cannot. Uranium cannot. Therefore, it only makes sense to use for fixed power stations those resources that do not compete with domestic users. Anyway, we've only 10 minutes left in the hour, which means that it's really not practicable to start reading anything new. On the other hand, she had a wart. I'm going to look, I've got some other things by Professor Jones. Book reviews out of Atom that I have typed up. I'm going to look and see if I've got anything good here. There's actually quite a lot of, let's see, these are, what, James Daglish. He was a common, frequent reviewer. Yes, Daglish was a frequent reviewer in Atom. But I'm pretty sure there's one from DJ Searby. Oh, yes, there's one by PMS Jones. It's a very, very long one. Here's a shorter one. Number 295, May. Towards the Nuclear Holocaust, Sir Martin Ryle, FRS, FNG. Let's see, friend of the Royal Society and fellow of the Royal Institute of Engineers, perhaps. The Menard Press, London, 32 pages, 75 pence. ISBN 0903400618. This short monograph by Sir Martin Ryle is mainly a presentation of his views on nuclear weapons, but it includes a few short and misleading pages on the nuclear industry. It is regrettable that these should contain so many errors of fact. The 15-gigawatt electric possible nuclear ordering program announced by the government in December 1979 leads to an installed nuclear capacity at the end of the century, allowing for Magnox retirements of 22 gigawatts electrical. The two figures are not, as Sir Martin suggests, incompatible. Professor Rotblatt's Guardian article, 29 May 1980, cited in the essay, which claimed that physical constraints meant that nuclear power could only meet 10% of the world's primary energy demand, is incompatible with the findings of the World Energy Conference and the International Nuclear Fuel Cycle Evaluation, and was based on an over-conservative view of the potential of fast reactors and world uranium resources. Something like twice this figure could be achieved by 2025, though whether it will depends on a number of factors, not least world economic growth. Numerous articles and whole books have appeared on the question of comparative risks in the energy industries, which serve to set the undoubted risks of uranium mining in perspective against the much larger risks of mining and using fossil fuels. The disposal of nuclear waste can scarcely be said to be, can scarcely be said not to be, quote, within sight of solution, when several routes are believed to be capable of dealing with the matter satisfactorily. The question of fossil fuels, of fossil station closures and nuclear orders have been dealt with extensively in the literature. Sir Martin seems unaware of the lead times involved and the fact that some 15 to 35 gigawatts of existing plant will reach the end of its useful life between now and the end of the century, regardless of economic growth. Sir Martin comments skeptically on the nuclear versus coal cost relativities. He says that the annex to the CEGB annual report shows nuclear capital costs to be only 30% higher than those for coal stations, which he says seems manifestly impossible. The figures in CEGB Table 4 are £88 sterling per kilowatt hour per annum for nuclear, per kilowatt per annum for nuclear, and £36 sterling per annum for coal, which includes a small component for the initial fuel charge and decommissioning for nuclear. See Atom 288, October 1980, pages 271-72. These figures are based on the capital cost spread over the station life and relate to the design capacity, not output. They reflect the fact that the nuclear station capital costs per kilowatt are twice those of the coal stations, not 30% higher. Sir Martin seems mistakenly to make some adjustment for load factors, although even then his 30% figure is hard to understand. Since 60% of AGR costs, or rather less for PWR, are concentrated in the nuclear island, with the remainder common to fossil and nuclear plant, it is hard to see where Sir Martin's problem arises. Sir Martin further alleges that nuclear programs are planned to provide plutonium for weapons and that without attaching a credit to plutonium, nuclear electricity would be uncompetitive. Again, he is in error. The UK's civil nuclear program is necessary to meet our energy requirements and not the plutonium requirements of our weapons program. Plutonium is not ascribed a value in calculations by the generating boards of nuclear generating costs. That there is no link between the economics of nuclear power and nuclear weapons is demonstrated by the number of countries with nuclear power programs who have no nuclear weapons. Indeed, plutonium credits, which figured in the early days when Magnox reactors first came on the scene, disappeared as the true levels of uranium resources became clearer in the early 1960s. We are all entitled to form our own views on nuclear deterrence, on objective, ethical, emotional, or any other grounds, or on any combination of arguments. Similarly, we can all have views on civil nuclear power. Professor Ryle's attempts to link the civil power program with the weapons program, for whatever reason, is neither objective nor accurate, and in no way helps the nuclear debate. PMS Jones. And then there are references, which are made in the text, to J.S. Foster, Prospective Energy Production, World Energy Conference, 1980, Volume RTB, page 31. Report of the International Nuclear Fuel Cycle Evaluation, 1980, IAEA, Vienna. W. Marshall, Letter, Guardian, June 12, 1980. PMS Jones, Letter, Guardian, July 31, 1980. W. Ramsey, The Unpaid Cost of Electricity, Johns Hopkins University Press, 1979. The Hazards of Conventional Sources of Energy, Health and Safety Executive, HMSO, 1978. See, for example, F. Jenkin, Why the CEGB is on Target, Electrical Review, 1980-207, December 12, 19. PMS Jones, Electrical Review, 1981-208, page 10. First Report of the Select Committee on Energy, Sessions, 1980-81, paragraph 48. R. Williams, The Nuclear Power Decisions, Krumhelm, London, 1980, page 68. Anyway. So, yes, there's... Yes, quite a lot here. I could probably read some of these reviews, actually. That might be cool. But I should remind you that you're listening to Anon Radio, to Hear Now the Words on anonradio.net, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix system, that if you find these programs interesting, you can write to me, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. If you find these programs worth supporting, you can send me money, paypal.me/PrometheusLives or patreon.com/Publius_reads for continuing expressions of support. Coming up next is Evolution Revolution with DJ Damaru. And let's see, I suppose I should also specify that my opinions are my own. I am not sponsored by the nuclear industry, no matter how much I might like to be. Matter of fact, they've given me no help whatsoever. And my opinions do not necessarily reflect those of the SDF Public Access Unix System or anybody else, no matter how much I might like them to.